You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot in the news today. I guess they're all every day. You know, it's like there's not a day that there isn't. In particular, you know, what's going on with net neutrality and the FCC. There's some fascinating stuff there. But here's something to consider. My father, when my father was dying, this was back in 2006, there was a drug that was in stage three trials. It had been stage one proven not to kill people when they took it. Stage two been proven that it actually had some positive effect on stopping the kind of cancer that he had. And stage three, they were giving people different doses, different people, to try to figure out what was the optimal dose. And then it would go into stage four trials after that, if I'm remembering all this right, and I'm sure Lucy Caldwell will correct me if I'm not. And then it would go into stage four trials after that, where they would determine, over the long term, give it to a bunch of people for a year or two and see if people started developing weird side effects that were unanticipated, their kidneys start to fail or something like that. He was eligible for this. We couldn't find a single doctor in Lansing, Michigan, who was willing to take the paperwork, the time for the paperwork, because insurance didn't pay for it. And when we offered to pay for it out of our pockets, the doctors said, we're not set up for that, and we just don't want to deal with this. But what if that, it's an interesting story, and I doubt it would have done anything for Dad. In fact, that drug has been pulled off the market since then. So it apparently didn't do all that much for mesothelioma anyway. But should it be or should it not be up to somebody like my father in the last weeks of or months of his life who is terminal to be able to say, you know, even though that drug hasn't made it all the way to stage three or stage four, I'll take it in an early stage where it might actually kill me. I might spend the next 3 weeks, you know, bleeding out of my eyeballs and in agonizing pain. But what the hell? There's a 5% chance I might survive. And the Goldwater Institute is all over this. Lucy Caldwell is with us. She's the communications director for the Goldwater Institute, goldwaterinstitute.org, a conservative think tank. Lucy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Here's my concern. I get it that the pharmaceutical companies want to make it basically easier for people like my dad to be guinea pigs. And in fact, I could make an argument for that. You know, some of these drugs, you know, people have died. One of my best friends, his wife died because she was in a stage four trial for I'm forgetting the name of the drug that my own wife took for breast cancer that's HER2 positive. But there was a new drug that was being developed, and Ron's wife was in a trial where she got the placebo and she died. And this drug actually stops that particular type of breast cancer, and it cured, as far as we know. I mean, it put my wife into remission. Had his wife had access to it earlier, she'd still be alive. So I can build that case. But on the other hand, in the last weeks of somebody's life, they're typically a little bit frantic, quite scattered, in a lot of pain, not thinking clearly. And they're certainly not qualified to read through a couple hundred pages of medical literature about the new drug they're going to take. It seems to me that somebody else needs to be in the room, somebody who's not interested in making a buck like the drug companies are, and yet, on the other hand, not interested in simply saying no or this is the way we always did it, you know, like some bureaucracies seem. How do we do that? How do we protect people like that?
Well, Tom, first I want to say I'm so sorry for your loss, and I'm so sorry for your friend's loss. And honestly, this story is a story of millions of Americans around the country who have had the experience of losing a loved one to terminal illness. About a million people are going to die in the U.S. this year from a terminal illness. And are there cures in trials for all of those diseases? Of course not. But there are drugs out there that could help these people that they can't gain access to. One of those patients was a woman named Michaela Knapp, and she was 25. She and her husband went on this just crazy intense tear in the last several months to try to get Michaela, a 25-year-old Berkeley graduate, access to a cutting-edge gene therapy. And she said on her deathbed, she said, there are people dying because they can't get access to these drugs, and I don't want to be one of them. And even she was in PR, even with all the resources she was marshaling, her husband, Stanford grad, they could not successfully lobby the FDA to get access to this drug. But I want to go back to something you said.
But there's
pharma.
There's another side to that that has to be mentioned at the same time. And again, I'll use a personal anecdote. I just because I was there and I saw it. One of our kids is a nurse. I mean, she's in fact has a PhD in nursing, and her fiance came down with leukemia, and they had a new drug in trials, and they went off to Chicago to try this drug, and it destroyed the last 4 months of his life. I mean, it devastated him. It didn't extend his lifespan at all. I barely recognized him. He probably swelled up to twice his normal size. His stomach looked like somebody stuffed 3 basketballs in there. It just devastated him. And I really, on the flip side is I was thinking this drug should have gone through a hell of a lot more trials before they tried it on Jeff.
Well, I do want to get back to what you said about pharma. Look, we would love pharma to be supportive of this measure because they can marshal a lot of resources, no doubt about it. But in fact, pharma hasn't even been out supporting this measure by and large. So I want to say, first of all, that this is not a matter of a pharma-driven initiative at all. This is an initiative that's driven by trying to have an answer to this struggle that millions of Americans are facing.
But if ALEC is supporting this, though, the American Legislative Exchange Council,
right,
they are exclusively, when legislation comes before ALEC, it is always some industry that is promoting it.
That's not true, Tom. But second of all, I believe that there was one presentation given on this at ALEC some time ago, but this is not a bill that came from ALEC. But hey, if ALEC would, it's our thing.
Okay,
darn it.
Cool. Well, it's out there. That's good.
ALEC always taking credit for stuff. I would love for groups like ALEC to get behind this. I would love for NCSL to get behind this.
Well, you're going to have to find a corporate sponsor if you want that to happen.
No. Because
they literally put lobbyists and legislators one-on-one in the rooms together. So you're going to have a lobbyist if you're going to run it through ALEC. I'm serious. This is how it works.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'll say this. Look, you're right. There are interest groups in this country. They're powerful. But when you have an issue that over 85% of Americans are supportive of, you can overcome a lot of those interests. And that's exactly what's happening with Right to Try. That's why with bipartisan support in Colorado, it was signed into law this week by a Democratic governor. It's going to pass through Louisiana shortly. It's going to pass through Missouri. It's going to go to the ballot in Arizona. I think we're going to see many other states by the end of the year passing this. And it sounds like you've had a lot of experience with the clinical trial process, including some bad experiences. But when you just look at the numbers, if I could just put this in terms of numbers. So let's just take cancer. About 500,000 patients a year in the U.S. are diagnosed with cancer. And when people get cancer, a lot of them want to get into a clinical trial. About 40% of cancer patients try to get into a clinical trial. But it's very hard to get into a clinical trial. Only about 3% of the sickest patients in America are able to get into a clinical trial when they're facing a terminal disease. So you're right that
because trials are expensive and the drug companies limit the number of people who can participate in them. They're costing the drug companies money.
Well, part of it is that we don't know exactly where the trials are. People get thrown out for a variety of reasons. But
right. Lucy, we're running out of time here. I wish we had more.
Okay, well, we'll get back together soon and share more ALEC conspiracy stories.
Okay. Yeah, no, the breaks are pre-programmed. I have no control over it. Lucy Caldwell, Communications Director with the Goldwater Institute.
Okay.
You can read all about it over at goldwaterinstitute.org. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. So, have you had any experience with this? What do you think? I mean, I'm very, very torn about this topic. We'll be back. Welcome back. Nate Sweet, international media superstar and producer with The Big Picture, is on the line with us. Mr. Sweet, how are you on this
phone? How's it going, Tom?
Good. So I have on my list here Mr. Papantonio beginning our program.
Yeah, Mike is very angry about net neutrality, and he's angry about it at the right time because there were hearings today on Capitol Hill in the House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology. A bunch of people, you know, there was a hearing. Tom Wheeler was there. He was grilled by Democrats, grilled by Republicans, too, and also praised by some Republicans as well. It's an interesting, you know, based on what I've seen from the hearing so far, both Democrats and Republicans are questioning the proposal, but for different reasons. And a lot of Republicans also are welcoming the FCC's new rules as well. So there's some interesting complexities there that we'll talk about with Pat.
Okay. And then we're going to have our big politics panel, a big picture politics panel, mm-hmm. Robin Carter Martin from Project 21. Nate Sweet, that would be you.
Yes.
And Mark Harrell, the Libertarian Party congressional candidate, actually, from Virginia's 11th district and author.
Always good to have Mark on the panel. Yeah. So we'll be talking about a couple things. We'll be talking about the Koch brothers are now involving themselves in Detroit's pension settlement. That's part of the bankruptcy proceedings up there. We'll be talking about Super Tuesday with their six primaries across the country today. Establishment Republicans are seeing this as their chance to take back the Republican Party from the Tea Party crazies. We'll be assessing whether or not that's an accurate depiction of what's going on. We'll be talking about the Credit Suisse guilty plea that they reached with the Justice Department yesterday. It's the first big bank to reach a guilty plea with federal regulators in a couple decades. So it's a big deal, but maybe it's not a big deal at all. Big deal, too. So we'll be talking about that. Also be talking about Justin Amash is now pushing again to attach an NSA reform amendment to the NDAA like he did last year. This comes on the heels of the USA Freedom Act's gutting in the House Judiciary Committee last week. So there's a bunch of stuff going on with NSA reform that's pretty complicated, but definitely great to talk about with our politics panel.
Mm-hmm.
We'll also be talking about Congressman John Lewis's comments about Michael Boggs, Obama's district court nominee for Georgia. The guy's pretty conservative. He actually supports using the Confederate flag. In the past, has supported using the Confederate flag as Georgia's flag. So definitely bizarre that President Obama would be pushing this guy as a nominee. But it shows you how powerful the Republican filibuster campaign has become.
Well, yeah, this was a deal that Obama cut with Saxby Chambliss and Johnny Isaacson, the two Georgia Republicans, that they would not block all seven of his judicial nominees if one of those seven was a right-wing crazy guy. Right, and so Obama put forward a right-wing crazy guy that they like, and now everybody else is going, what? You know, huh?
Yeah, and of course, you know, you'll have Republicans pointing. Republicans are going to try to say that Democrats are being hypocrites here, but then again, Democrats have never abused the filibuster quite like Republicans have over the past 6 years, the Obama administration.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll also be talking about the AT&T and DirecTV buyout as well, and what the consequences are of that for both the media world and for the internet world as well. And finally, we'll be talking with Yan Zhu, he's an encryption expert. We'll be talking about ways you can encrypt your phone to protect your internet to protect yourself from the NSA. Definitely a big trend that's been going on since the Snowden revelations.
Well, and a lot of people want to protect themselves not just from the NSA but from Google as well.
Right. Well, the line starts to blur there when you're talking about Silicon Valley and the NSA. They're pretty
tragically
intricately connected.
Yeah. Okay. Nate Sweet. I'll see you tonight, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Sue Nethercutt visiting us from the UK this week. Runs our chat room, does our newsletter, and a variety of other things. And Sue's hotel is just down from the mall. And she was, she showed us some pictures when she came in. She went down and visited the 10 to 30 million man march, where they're going to march on Washington, D.C. and demand that President Obama voluntarily step down from office, and Joe Biden with him, and Nancy Pelosi, too, and even John Boehner. We don't even like him. And they apparently either thought Glenn Beck was with them or think he should be or something. There's an article, bradblog.com has a really interesting article about this. Glenn Beck's natives are getting very restless, and many of them are now taking their frustrations out on him. Very interesting. So, anyway, back to this issue of pharmaceuticals and medicine in the United States. Because we have a profit-driven healthcare system, and Obamacare didn't solve that. It expanded to 20-some-odd states for poor people, for working poor people. You can't be real, real poor and be eligible for the Medicaid expansion. You have to have a certain amount of income. So it's basically for the working poor. It expanded a single-payer system for them, but basically everybody else just got forced to buy into health insurance from companies that are skimming 15 or 20% off the top and paying their stockholders big bucks and their CEOs big bucks. And you know the drill. But they have to do it under rules that are at least not, you know, ripping us off and killing us like they used to. So, you know, it's a step forward. I'm pro Obamacare. And I particularly like the fact that it's got an option in it that says that after 2016, if a state thinks that they can insure everybody in the state and they can do it with any kind of system that's better than Obamacare, go for it. And I can just see, you know, the Wyoming saying, yeah, we're going to do that. We're just going to say, hey, y'all get insurance. We'll do it the libertarian way. And then nobody gets insurance and somebody gets sick. And then they start fighting about who's going to pay for the hospital bill, because Ronald Reagan back in 1986 championed and passed a law that said that if you show up in an emergency room, they got to see you. Ooh, that's a problem. Well, maybe they could do away with that, too. And then it would be back to the, you know, the Ron Paul question. What do you do with somebody who's 30 years old and just, you know, got hit by a car or had a stroke or something? He's laying in the street, he's bleeding. And the guy in the audience goes, let him die! Because he doesn't have insurance, right? Could be. But because we have this for-profit system, first of all, the drug, it's making me crazy. I can't remember the name of this drug that Louise took that is specific to this, you know, triple-positive HER2 type of breast cancer, which is what she had. It was $100,000. Now, we didn't have to pay that because we had health insurance, but we did have to pay that because we have health insurance, if you know what I mean. I mean, we all paid for that. And part of that, I mean, and much of the development of that drug and many of these other drugs came not so much out of the pharmaceutical companies, although much of it does now, but came out of the National Institutes of Health. But what about the people who didn't qualify for the trials? Or what about when the trials are really, you know, they're still in the early kind of really screwing it up stage? And what about the fact that the trials are being run by for-profit companies, and so they're really trying to do the absolute minimum necessary to satisfy the FDA that their drug is safe, effective, and that they've nailed down what the side effects are? And if they can do that with 70 people in the trial, then there's no way they're going to let 700 people in, because they've got to supervise every single person. They've got to track every single person. There's costs associated with that. So are we supposed to pay the costs? Are the pharmaceutical companies supposed to pay the costs? These are questions that, you know, if Lucy was still with us, I would raise. You know, how is it that a conservative think tank is promoting this idea that may actually raise the costs either to the for-profit companies or socialize the cost all of it? Well, I guess, you know, conservatives are all in favor of socializing costs. If there's, you know, if it'll mean more profit and a rapider profit, a quicker profit for the pharmaceutical companies, because they're getting basically more guinea pigs in their trials rapidly, and they can somehow figure out a way to have you and me, the taxpayers, pay for it. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is the case with the Goldwater Institute. I'm just thinking, if I was a right-wing think tank, if I was the Mercatus Center, you know, over at George Mason University, how would I want to organize this? I don't know. Maybe it's not even a good talk radio topic, because there's not a clear answer to this or a clear, you know. But I do think that if we took the profit motive out and said instead these things have to be done on a nonprofit basis by nonprofit organizations, you know, research organizations, and we funded them really well, But they could be independent nonprofits, so it doesn't have to be the government, but just, you know, answerable to, well-regulated. I mean, that might be a middle ground. I don't know. Anything's possible. Anyhow, I heard the most amazing thing. Yesterday I was telling you about when I was I woke up to NPR and heard, you know, right-wing gibberish. It happened again today. It happened again. I mean, I was just astounded. It absolutely took my breath away. I'm laying there in bed listening to the radio at the, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was, you know, to wake me up. And it's like, well, let's ask a right-wing think tank that's funded by the Koch brothers their opinion of this. And I was like, really? I mean, that's not how they said it, obviously. They try to make it seem like it's all very correct. But I'll share that with you right after we come back from the break. And, you know, some serious questions about the state of our media. And then we'll pick up your calls. And by the way, Ben Cohen's going to be with us at 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Would you take a shot at a drug that might kill you or make the rest of your life horrible if there was a 5% chance it would save you? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, strangest stuff in the news. This guy. Anyhow, yesterday it was Oregon. A federal judge said, sorry, your ban on gay marriages is unconstitutional. Today it was Pennsylvania. This is going to spread across the country by the end of the year. Well, I mean, there'll be a few holdouts, and they'll be in the South. But, and which gets us back to the debate, you know, my wife's idea, Louise's idea. Should Abraham Lincoln, when General Lee said, you know, we're out of here, buddy, should Lincoln have said, okay, see you later? Now, I realize there are we have a lot of listeners and a lot of viewers in red states in the South, and I did, and you know, whenever I say that, I get calls from people going, what? And I'm not saying that we should do that now. My suggestion for now is that we take a good-sized chunk of West Texas, and anybody who's progressive who lives there, we offer them a decent buyout, and we turn it into its own country. Call it Galt's Gulch, right? John Galt, you know, for the famous place where all the billionaires went from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, and just let them all go there. So anyhow, the Mercatus Institute is this right-wing think tank, in quotes. I mean, it's a, you know, think tank, really, they think. It's this white-wing group that was funded with, I think, $30 million, some mind-boggling amount of money from the Koch brothers to attach that they gave to George Mason University to attach this think tank to it to give it credibility. There was a piece about it in the New Yorker recently in which they described it as essentially a scam, quote, to take corporate money and give it to a neutral-sounding think tank, end quote. And this article about it that's over in Blue Virginia, U.S., says the Mercatus is very useful to the Koch brothers, of course, because they can count on the clueless media to cite it as some sort of unbiased, neutral think tank, when in reality is wildly biased and certainly not a think tank the way most people would ever think of that concept. The governor of Virginia, Bob McDonald, and his wife took over $100,000 worth of goodies, apparently, or are alleged to have taken, from this guy who had this nutritional supplement company. In exchange for that, they appeared at his events, and they had the government buying his stuff, and they were promoting his things, and all these kind of allegations. And so I'm waking up this morning, and I'm hearing an NPR story about how the prosecutors in Virginia, right across the border from D.C. from here, want to split McDonald and his wife apart and prosecute them separately, which will make the prosecution more difficult. And then all of a sudden, hey, we're NPR, or we're the local affiliate of NPR. Here's an opportunity to put a right-wing think tank's view in here about something that has something to do with this. Listen to this and make up your own mind.
The former governor and his wife are charged in a 14-count indictment with accepting more than $165,000 from Johnny Williams, the former CEO of dietary supplement maker Star Scientific. In exchange, prosecutors say the McDonald's helped promote his products. Matthew Mitchell is a senior researcher for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He says the case against the McDonald's is evidence that governors should stay away from economic development.
Nobody seems to be focusing on maybe we ought to take away that responsibility or that power of a governor to favor particular firms, because that's really at the heart of the case.
The McDonald's have pleaded not guilty. A jury trial that is expected to last at least 5 weeks is scheduled to begin in late July.
Yeah, we have a corrupt governor because big government, right? Yeah. Really? Shouldn't we just, you know, I mean, if you're going to get somebody to give you a quote on what's going on, shouldn't the quote be something like, and from, you know, from a good government group, you know, one of Ralph Nader's groups? So he's too lefty for you. Okay. The League of Winnemun Voters, from some group that says, you know, we just really can't tolerate governors taking money from companies to promote their stuff. This had nothing to do with his official function as a governor. This was not part of his job description. This is corruption. This is old-fashioned. That's why he's in. I don't know if he's in jail right now, but that's why, you know, he did the perp walk. Anyway, more of that rant later. Tim in Rockvale, Tennessee. You wanted to discuss the clinical trials. What's up?
Yes, Tom. I'm totally blue, stuck in a red state here, so. I know that feeling.
Yeah.
I'm currently in a clinical trial for my MS. I just got back from the clinic today, as a matter of fact. I'm 9 months into it, and it's for a drug called alemtuzumab. Brand name is Lemtrada. They're trying to get it approved. And it's already been up for approval, and they've kicked it back to the company and said, we need more data. And I'm in another trial that has nothing to do with that. But the theory in the MS community is, since it's only a dose, two doses, 1 year apart that you get of this medicine, you know, there's not that much profit in it. You know, you can't, all these other MS treatments are a daily dose or weekly dose or a monthly dose, and you can, and it never stops.
Right.
And so the theory is that they're holding this one up because it's not going to be as long-term profitable.
Oh, geez.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Is this, by the way, just if you don't mind my curiosity, is this a drug that reduces the reactivity of your immune system?
Yes, it is. It's actually it's been used for for lymphoma for years at a higher dose.
Mm-hmm.
It's been used for MS in Europe for a long time. My doctor has been using this drug off label for at least 5 years, and
wow.
It's his drug of choice.
Yeah.
And he's probably the best MS specialist here in Middle Tennessee that I know of.
Huh.
And it sounds like a plausible theory to me that it's been up for approval. They gave all the data to the FDA, and they said, no, we need more data. And where it stands right now, it's in a holding pattern. And the theory is that's why.
Amazing.
There's just not as much money as the rest of the medicines.
Amazing. I don't want to even come close to offering, particularly somebody who actually is suffering from a disease, medical advice. But I do want to tell you, I have a friend who lives in the UK who is selling. The New York Times did a really great article about this back a couple of years ago, and I wrote a chapter about it in my book, Threshold, because it shows the nature of the interconnectedness between humans and nature. And what they found is that people who don't have parasites, specifically hookworms and roundworms, I think, or whipworms, I guess they are, which we all had for 160,000 years, and they've only been out of our gut for the last 50 or 60 years or so. People who don't, you know, what these worms do is, so that the body doesn't expel them, is they actually downregulate our immune system. We have their DNA in ours, and they have human DNA in their DNA. And this guy is supplying through the British Medical Service and to people with MS and some other conditions that are reactive immune system, hookworms. And there's a whole thing. It's called helminthic therapy that is generally not available in the United States. Again, there's no profit to be made in it. And it sounds totally weird, you know, getting worms to deal with an autoimmune disorder. But apparently it's useful for a whole variety of autoimmune disorders. But anyway, just wanted to toss that out.
Before, and I came close to even trying to look into how could I find some, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's available in the States or not. I didn't get that far.
If you Google or you know, put in the search H-E-L-M-I-N-T-H, helminth, which is a scientific word for worms, therapy, uh-huh, and MS, you will find hundreds and hundreds of hits, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So,
yes.
Anyhow, Tim, good luck. I wish you the very best, my friend.
Thank you.
Good luck. Raymond in Washington, listening on in Roy, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Raymond, what's up?
Oh, not much. I was in a trial with the formaldehyde. Its common name is Dulera. It's a single active beta antagonist for my asthma. And we had to stop it because I was going wrong on it. It was it causes asthma related exacerbation.
Yeah,
I'm a severe asthmatic, and it swelled my throat to the point that I could barely swallow or talk. It took me 2 months to recover from that. But your question was, would I try something again? Yes, I would.
Yeah.
You know, I'm dying not because of me, but because what the government did to me. And if somebody can benefit from me trying something, I'd be more than willing to do that.
Yeah. And which raises the question of, for example, there are literally thousands of papers published internationally on the medical benefits of medical marijuana. Why aren't we doing something with that? Again, I think it's because nobody's figured out a way to make a buck off it. The main thing that my friend with the worms uses the worms for is asthma. You know, why aren't we doing something with that? You can't make a buck off it.
And the medical marijuana, the liquid form, is what I use for my pain management.
You do? Does it work?
Really good. Yes, it does. They took away the high euphoric stuff, so I'm not a vegetable. But I've got 21 pain pills. Like, and I love it. I'm not taking some pills anymore.
So you're getting the stuff that is high in the cannabinoids, but not in the tetrahydrocannabinol. It's high in the stuff that's therapeutic and low in the stuff that gets you high. Well, good on you, Raymond, and I wish you the very best. I'm torn on this. If I knew that I had 6 months to live, and there was a chance that a drug would make my life hell, but it might extend my life for another 6 months, my inclination would be not to do that, personally.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
As much as I value life, I think my inclination would be to try to make the most of every single day of those 6 months and hang on to the quality of my life to the extent that I could. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And as Shane just pointed out, and this was my whole point with what was her name, Jennifer? The woman, Lucy Caldwell, that we had on from the Goldwater Institute. Is, you know, somebody's dying, they're in pain, they're frantic, they're frightened. Is there any way that they can actually provide informed consent? I mean, you have to ask about, you know, the state of somebody's mind at that point in time. David in Catlett, Virginia, watching us on Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was going to mention that you were talking about Governor McDonald, ex-Governor McDonald, Virginia. But, you know, he is a political professor now at Liberty University.
Honest to God?
Yes.
While he's indicted?
Yes. So I guess, you know, that this whole, you know, I consider myself a Christian and a student of the Bible and Jesus' progressive thinking. It seems like the Christian community doesn't embrace any of those ideas.
Well,
they simply have an agenda, a pious agenda, and anybody that spews what they want is somehow holy. And somehow it's supposed to affect young people in a positive way, even on an indictment.
Yeah, I call myself a Christian too, and I'm you know, I've read the Bible 4 times from cover to cover, and even was ordained and was the pastor of a church for 2 years back in the 70s in Detroit. But I don't understand why any Christian organization would want to have a corrupt former governor. Well, is Liberty University a Christian organization, or is it just basically, you know, a right-wing, you know, second level law school.
Well, no. In other words, you know, it used to be Liberty Baptist College, Jerry Falwell's university.
Yeah. So it used to be where people went to become Baptist preachers?
Well, I think they have one of these general degrees for people basically to go out and open churches and, you know, present these ideas that is just, you know, a political conservatism under the guise of religion.
Yeah.
And really, you know, when you see them as a religion or a political organization, which unfortunately a lot of these big ministries are.
Right, right. But why would they hire Bob McDonald? And what's it, by the way, you apparently know more about his current situation than I do. It appeared to me from a lot of the news reports that either A, his wife was pushing a lot of this, you know, let's get these Ferraris and Rolexes and minks from this guy, or B, that he was pushing the idea, that his wife was pushing the idea.
Plus, you know, the guy picked up the tab on his daughter's wedding.
Right.
I think two daughters' weddings.
Among other things. Right.
Among other things.
So, are they still together, do you know?
I think they are, yes. I think they are. And they even the, you know, the Speaker of the House there certified him to the prosecutors to be a person of good character and all this. Whatnot.
Well, you would expect that. I mean, you know, your friends hopefully come to your defense and say, you know, might have made a mistake, but he's a decent guy.
What's interesting here, Virginia, is now we have a Democratic governor.
Right.
They are, of course, wanting to promote, the Medicare reimbursement for people.
Right, expanding Medicare, yeah.
And so now, you know, they're not voting the budget in because of that.
Oh, I know. It's an absolute mess. It's an absolute mess. David, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Amy in Madison, Wisconsin, listening on 92.1 The Mic. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I got to ask you, because I don't fully understand this, but my whole family lives in New York around the city, and I was there for my 60th birthday. They flew me out, and my cousin has MS, right? Mm-hmm. She's in a wheelchair.
Ouch.
So I went to visit her in Manhattan, and she's being strung along with, like, blood stem cell research. She's on Medicare with a supplement. I don't know if Medicare does it or an MS organization does it.
MS is serious stuff. I hope that nobody construes my comments as, gee, it's a minor disease, and if you just get some worms or something, it'll cure. It's serious stuff. I have a cousin who's had MS for the better part of 20 years, and I've watched it just, you know, eat him apart. He's pretty much down to a wheelchair now. And
so is my cousin.
Yeah. So,
and,
take it seriously.
No, she's almost helpless to the system.
Right. So do you have a question, or did you want to just share that story?
I have a question. Is it Medicare?
Oh, I don't know. What your cousin has access to, I don't know. And if she's in some kind of a trial that has to do with stem cell therapies, I would be very surprised if that's Medicare or Medicaid. My guess would be that she's been able to get enrolled in one of these, private pharmaceutical companies or some, you know, university research, but I don't know. Amy, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to 92.1 FM. Peggy in Rapid City, South Dakota, listening on WCPT. Hey, Peggy, what's up?
Hi. I listen to your show quite often, and many times you speak of the autoimmune syndromes, and I'm one that was, after several emergency room visits, they finally diagnosed me with severe gluten intolerance. So they put me on what's called the celiac diet, and within 3 months, I was one of those skinny diabetics since 15 years old. My diabetes was gone, which is an autoimmune diabetes, and within 7 months, my MS symptoms were gone. And they had me on a grain-free diet, and so all vegetables and leafy greens and lean meats. And
yeah.
So when the doctors saw me, what they call clean up my chart, they had me speak at the local medical center and to several doctors, and then again at the local hospital, and they're like, how did you do this?
Right.
And every doctor, you know, I broke my ankle a year later because I was helping my husband be a lumberjack and stepped in a hole carrying a big armload of wood. And when I went into the medical center again with a different doctor, she looked at my chart and I go, this is impossible. How did you do this? How did you do this? Right. And so you can see it online. This is one doctor that was in the wheelchair and special beds with her MS. And she essentially went on the same diet, and she calls it minding your mitochondria, mm-hmm. by just eating platefuls of greens.
Right, yeah, the mitochondria being the little energy-producing parts of the cell. It's like a cell within the cell.
Correct, correct. And so she left off all what she calls the anti-nutrients, the grains that require more of our energy and more of our vitamin stores to digest, and eating all those foods that feed the mitochondria rather than the body doing what it can to just absorb all the anti-nutrients of the grain product.
Right. Fascinating
and
stuff.
You can't even tell she's ever had MS, and she had it more severely than me.
Wow.
I had some speaking.
See, there's two theories that I've heard on that, Peggy. One is that we're not designed to eat grains. We don't have teeth like cows do, and they're designed to eat grass seed, basically. And grains are grass seed. And the other is that the glyphosate, also known as Roundup, prevents the gut from cleaving gluten into amino acids. And gluten itself is toxic. And so it gets into the small intestine and starts killing off the villi and just, you know, wreaks havoc with both the immune system and the metabolic balance of nutrients. And you can track this explosion in celiac disease to the explosion in the use of glyphosate, of Roundup. And I'm curiously watching both of these. As somebody who himself has a diagnosable celiac disease, I find it all very fascinating. Peggy, I got to run. Thank you very much for the call, and hopefully we can continue the conversation later. Ben Cohen's on the line with us, the co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, activist and founder of Stamped to get – actually, that's – I'm only seeing part of this here. Stampede.org. To get money out of politics, and also speaking on behalf of the Washington State effort to amend the Constitution, wamend.org. Hey, Ben.
Yo, Tom, how you doing?
Just great. Welcome back to the program. How you doing?
Good to be here. I am in Seattle, Washington at the moment, and it is an incredibly beautiful day. And we're here gathering signatures to get the ballot initiative on the ballot here in Washington to get money out of politics.
That's wonderful. And that's at wamend.org, W-A-M-E-N-D, as in Washington, amend, wamend.org. And then, of course, your website, stampede.org, right?
Right. Yeah, we're the Stampede is a national organization that's working to build the movement to amend the Constitution to get money out.
Yep.
And we do it by stamping paper currency.
Yeah, we had you on our TV show, Stamping Dollar Bills. It was a hoot.
Yep. And now there's 15,000 people around the country that are doing it, and it's really gathering momentum. But
wow.
The big thing is the next ground zero for this campaign is here in the state of Washington and getting this amendment passed. So we need people to go to wamend.org. And get a petition.
Yeah, if they live in Washington State, sign up. And if they are outside Washington State, kick in a few bucks.
There you go.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward stuff. And this is to put on the ballot so that the citizens can vote. It's not actually going to do anything. Although it moves us as a country closer to this, it puts Washington State on the record as saying if a constitutional amendment comes down the road from Congress or up the road from the states, we're on with it to say money's not speech and corporations aren't persons. And it's a really important thing. Do I have that right, Ben?
Yeah. So they would be the 17th state to do it.
That would be incredible. Ben Cohen, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. You can check out his website at stampstampede.org. And, of course, get over to WAMEND, WAMEND.org right now. Ben, thanks so much for being with us.
All right.
Good talking to you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio, host of a Ring of Fire Radio, America's lawyer, ringoffireradio.com, and Ring of Fire TV as well, on Free Speech TV, is on the line with us. Hey, Pap.
Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope you are well.
Mm-hmm. Things are good here. I
understand you're a little fired up about net neutrality. We Congress is talking about this, and I've only been sort of half paying attention to it. So many other things going on, and I know that you've been really focused on it like a laser. What's going on?
Well, policy, you start here, Tom. Policy for the FCC in past years has always been that the Internet provides it requires that slow channels and fast channels aren't there, that there's no rich man, no poor man channel, that it's not a business of have and have nots. But that was before AT&T and Verizon became fully and completely active, an active arm of the NSA, willing to spy on their customers by turning their phone records in, their Twitter records in, their messages in, their Facebook information in, over to the government, over to the NSA. That's what changed things. And they get, and think about this, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast get total immunity for doing all of that, both by way of Bush and both by way of Obama. So remember how one of their defenses, Tom, was, gee whiz, we're being ordered to do it, and by golly, we're not really making any money right now by doing it. Well, now we see that Comcast and AT&T and Verizon all knew that the big payday was coming. If they simply would do what the government told them to do, they have a profit bonanza that this administration wants to give them. They want to give them a web where AT&T has a super fast a channel for people with money, companies with huge dollars, and a poor man's channel that's almost prehistoric, a 56K dial-up dinosaur modem kind of thing. And it's a system where AT&T and Verizon, out of vengeance, out of envy, out of political differences, they can make activists and critics and political opponents and competitors, they can make them disappear. They can buffer them out of existence. They can freeze the images of them out of existence. They can engage in non-delivery entirely. They know the numbers. They know that most people watching this program, if this is buffering right now, they're changing the channel. So we've seen the big, we saw the big first payday, if you remember, 2006. In 2006, Obama declined, in this administration, think about this, declined to even investigate telecom providers, even though individual lawsuits were springing up all over. You had lawyers that had uncovered all kinds of complicity between the NSA and the telecom providers, and there was no reason for the administration to do that. The cases were very clear. The biggest joke here is, and this is the most bothersome thing about the story, Tom. The biggest joke is that it's Tom Wheeler, In who's an ex-telecom lobbyist, by the way, and Obama appointment to the FCC, that Tom Wheeler is trying to make the American public believe that there's real public discourse going on here, that they really care about the opinions. They already have this done. As a matter of fact, the entire lawsuit is a sham. It's exactly what we saw with Citizens United. The Supreme Court wanted the case, so the lawsuit was filed. Same thing we see with gun activists. They want the Supreme Court wants the issue, so the lawsuit is filed. Same thing we see on voting. The people that want to take votes away want the lawsuit. The Supreme Court wants the lawsuit, so it's filed. This is the same thing. Verizon versus FCC is nothing different than Citizens United. It's a sham. It's simply there as window dressing to make all of us believe that discourse is really the issue. This is a done deal, Tom.
Yeah,
AT&T and Verizon and Comcast. Now, that doesn't mean we stop. Doesn't mean we don't do anything about it. But I'm just telling you, this is the mentality there in Washington right now.
Well, here's the thing that blows my mind is the way the media is dealing with this. And let's take what's supposed to be the most neutral media in America, National Public Radio. This was what I woke up to yesterday. It's a little 30-second clip here. Listen to this. About what, trying to explain the issue about why these giant companies had to get twice as giant. Notice the word monopoly is not mentioned here at all. Just listen to this, Pep.
If you've streamed a movie or a TV show recently, you are part of the problem facing cable and satellite providers. These companies are facing more and more competition from internet streaming, and to survive, some are consolidating. Yesterday, AT&T announced that it is buying the satellite TV provider DirecTV. The deal, which still needs to be approved by government regulators, would be worth nearly $50 billion.
Now, I thought at least they could have the decency to say the deal, which has to be approved by the people who look out for monopolies. I mean,
well,
but it's our fault, really, because I watched Netflix last night. It's my fault.
Yeah, you did this, Tom. Listen, the real problem is the media can't even understand this story. They don't understand what I just talked about. Go try to find the discussion about the idea that the payday for AT&T and Comcast, and it is the payday is for them spying on Americans, is, look, just do this for us. We're going to give you immunity. I know it's hurt your customer base. People are mad at you. But you know what? Be patient, and Tom Wheeler is going to give you your payday. And it's going to come in a way that nobody really suspects. It's going to look like all of this public discourse really matters. It doesn't matter. It's a done deal. And so I'm not saying stop. We have to continue trying, but you have to understand the mechanics of how this came about. If you try to understand this story, you'll never understand it from corporate media. Comcast, I mean, well, they're going to tell the story. They're going to say, yeah, we knew when we were handing over information about phone records and messages and tweets.
I don't think I've ever seen that discussed on MSNBC or NBC.
Well, I don't think it's discussed anywhere, frankly. I just don't think it's discussed anywhere.
It's an old boys' network. It's an old boys' network.
Yeah. Well, worse than that, the average reporter doesn't even get it. The average reporter doesn't understand. Nothing happens simply by coincidence. Verizon didn't file this case, you know, in the way that they filed it by coincidence. They were asked to file it. There was an agreement to file it because they knew when they filed it that Tom Wheeler and the FCC was going to take care of them. I mean, that's what this is about. And so the truth is, there's going to be two channels. It's going to be a fast channel and a slow channel. And you're going to see that if Comcast or Verizon, if they have an activist they don't like or a critic or a political opponent or a competitor, they're going to make them disappear. They're going to buffer them away. They're going to frozen image them away. They're going to non-deliver them away.
Right. Just as they've done with cable television, by the way. I mean, there's some substantial barriers to access to cable television.
It happened with telephone system, Tom. Think back.
Yeah.
Think about the small carriers that tried to move into the business, and what was the payoff? You followed the money on that. This is, if you take that instance, if you take that scenario and you compare it to this, is it exactly the same? The money was spread around exactly the same, and the outcome will be exactly the same.
Yeah, there was that little window there after Jimmy Carter broke up AT&T into seven regional companies and spun off Lucian Technologies, where small phone companies were appearing in towns all over America. They got squashed like bugs, didn't they?
There hasn't been a Jimmy Carter around for a long time, and don't expect anything like Jimmy Carter out of this administration. Tom Wheeler is part of the problem. What I love about Tom Wheeler, even though he's a pimp for the NSA even though he's simply going to say whatever he has to say to make it look like this is an arm's length discussion, that this is a real lawsuit and they're really concerned about public discourse. He's very good at it. If you listen to him talk, you're almost convinced that this guy's for real. He's not for real.
Yeah.
He's a fraud.
Well,
and this is all window dressing.
That's how you get to be a multimillionaire lobbyist, is by sounding really convincing.
Yes.
It's amazing. Mike Papantonio, author, America's lawyer, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, and Ring of Fire TV over on Free Speech TV. Pap, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, Pap is... We've got Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Sam Cedar and David Bender, a whole bunch of great folks hanging out with him over at ringoffireradio.com. Mr. Papantonio, or is it Dr. Papantonio? Are you a doctor of law?
JD, I guess.
Did you ever read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas?
No, I never did.
Oh,
I love Hunter Thompson.
You've got to read that book as a personal favor. Because the guy, you know, Hunter Thompson's... friend is his lawyer, and his lawyer says, you know, says, call me doc, because he's got a JD, you know, so he's always having to call him doctor. But anyway,
what a great loss it was to lose Hunter Thompson.
Yeah, it really was. He was a brilliant and troubled man.
Very troubled.
Yeah. So what's Ring of Fire TV here on Free Speech TV? What's coming up this week?
Well, I've got Howard Nation. He's going to be talking about how the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce, all the regular suspect, he's going to give the details of how they're going about changing the judiciary by buying the judiciary. I'm going to have David Nywert talk about the latest in Looney Town out there with the Bundy crowd. This story is getting weirder and weirder. You know, David is now a writer for a Southern Poverty Law Center, and he follows all these fascist white supremacist freaks, and so he's got some really interesting takes on the story. And then, Tom, I have you. Your discussion this week is one of my all-time favorites. Tune in and listen to what you said, because you really said it well. Michael Berg is going to be talking about how corporations are leaving America. What's the methodology that they're leaving America to avoid taxes, and how is our government actually promoting them leaving in America? And then Sam Cedar and I are going to be talking about the news of the day. What are the stories behind the story? So it's a good lineup. We're always trying to go where nobody else is as best we can. And it's like Babe Ruth said, they asked him, how'd you hit so many home runs? And he said, I tried to hit them where they ain't. And that's what we try to do on our show, is go where other people are not.
The buying of the federal judiciary, does that have anything to do with the Federalist Society? Can you tell me about that?
Well, the Federalist Society, I think, explained what it did is it brought the conservative right movement into the world of judicial decisions. It educated them about how you can have a president or a senate creating all the laws you want, and then those laws simply disappear in federal appellate courts, in federal trial courts, at the Supreme Court level. And so what they figured out is, and they've passed it on, even though they said there should not be judicial activism, what they really did is educated conservatives about how to stop laws like Obamacare from ever taking place, or gun laws that are supposed to protect the citizenry. You simply put the right judges in the right place. You then shop the forums. You try to get your case in front of the right person, in front of the right judge, and then you let that judge make a ruling in a split decision with another jurisdiction, and then pump it up to the Supreme Court. It's a whole mechanism, and those types of things are discussed ad nauseum with the Federalist Society kind of writing.
Haven't they? I mean, since that was one of the things that started at the same time that the Heritage Foundation and ALEC, and I mean, this is all back late 70s, early 80s, the result of the Powell memo and the Koch brothers,
right.
You know, David Koch getting disenchanted with not being elected vice president as libertarian.
It was actually before then.
They
launched this notion before then, all the way back to Sagebrush Rebellion.
Okay. You got to educate me about that one of these days. Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV, ringoffireradio.com, the website, Ring of Fire TV, right here on Free Speech TV, Sundays at noon. Be sure to check it out. And then it replays every day of the week. You can check your listings. Pap, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
See you soon.
Welcome
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Roger Hickey is on the line with me. He is the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, CAF. The website is ourfuture.org. And Roger, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you. Congratulations on your book, The Crash of 2016.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Very, very important book. Everybody had to read it.
Thank you. You guys have a conference coming up day after tomorrow, Thursday, the 22nd of May, featuring keynote speaker Elizabeth Warren on the new populism. It's here in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Court Hotel. And, of course, people, for information, they can just go over to ourfuture.org. Why the new populism? Tell me what this is all about.
Well, as Elizabeth Warren says in her book and all over the country these days, the problem that people are starting to feel is that the rules of the game, especially of the economy in America, have been rigged. They've been rigged in favor of the big guys. And traditionally, as you show in your book, every once in a while we have a big coming together of the people against the big guys, and for a while we have a populist movement that reorganizes power in America. We've done that several times in our history, and it's about time for a new populist movement that unrigs the rules, that puts the focus on an economy that works for working people, and that's what we're talking about at this conference on the 22nd. And that's what people are already working on building all over the country. We're going to have people from lots of different areas talking about how we're building a movement, a new populist movement.
That's spectacular. We had Ralph Nader on a couple of days ago. He's got a new book out called Unstoppable. And his point is that there are 27 different, if I'm remembering right, maybe it was 29, but I think it's 27 different topics where, for example, money and politics, where libertarians and Tea Partiers and Occupy movement and progressive Democrats all agree. It skips the left-right frame entirely,
yeah. Right.
Purely populist frame, and that there are a bunch of these things, and there's enough of them now, and people are PO'd enough now that it's not even necessary to say, hey, you know, we need to go conservative or we need to go progressive. We need to go populist. We need to go, and most people don't understand that word, but we just need to acknowledge what the American people want, and they're fed up with the corruption of our political system. They're fed up with billionaires owning our political system. Their eyes roll when they see, you know, people go out to Shelley Adelson to kiss his ring so that he'll give them millions of dollars and launch their presidential campaigns. I mean, it just as a beginning, you know, the net neutrality, they're seeing all these big internet companies getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and yet they still can't get a customer service representative on the phone. I mean, you know, it goes on and on and on.
Yep. And especially in the area of the economy.
Yeah.
I want all of your listeners to turn to populistmajority.org. It's a new website we put together. And it shows that it's not just the left, it's not just the liberals who want to invest in good jobs and achieve full employment. We want to ensure that everybody who works full-time should not be in poverty. Vast numbers of Americans agree with that we ought to raise wages. That breaking up the banks that are too big to fail is a good idea, and we're going to have Sherrod Brown talking about his bill at the conference, that we should increase Social Security instead of cutting Social Security. All of these things, that we ought to tax the wealthy and the big corporations instead of the little guys, all of these things are supported by the vast majority of Americans, no matter what they call themselves. And we just need some political leadership, and we need some political organizing to goose them along to transform this country and make it work for average working people.
And I, you know, since 2008, I've been saying this about the Tea Party, that this is, even though it originally was started, I mean, as you well know, it was originally started back in the 80s by the tobacco industry as the People's Tea Party to protest government regulation of tobacco.
Right.
You know, I want to have the right to smoke, especially in public,
yep,
or especially in my office. And it never really went anywhere, but they picked up the identical infrastructure. I mean, literally the same people, the same think tanks, the same offices, the same, you know, trademark of the brand and everything, the websites. they picked it up and reinvented it at, you know, by some very, very wealthy people. But the vast majority of the people who showed up at Tea Party events, like here in Washington, D.C., and I'd go out and talk to these people, and they weren't, you know, I mean, they were partisan to the extent that they watched too much Fox News, but this is really a populist movement, and you know, they know they're being screwed. They may not know who is screwing them. They may not be politically sophisticated, but I think that the reason why this 30 million man march on Washington, D.C., Sue is visiting us from the U.K. This week. She runs our chat room and does our newsletter and things. And she walked over there this morning and said hi to them. There's like eight guys, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're occupying them all for a week. Yep. And it's supposed to be 30 million people. They're very upset with Glenn Beck that he didn't deliver. The reason I think that, you know, there's nobody showing up anymore is because it's lost its populist focus. This march was supposed to be about throw Obama out of office. Well, populists don't care about that. They care about pocketbook issues.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we've got a whole lot of disgruntled people. By and large, neither party is speaking to their interests. And that's why our view is that we've got to get together and organize. We've got to build a movement around raising wages, full employment, breaking up the banks, protecting Social Security, college education for everybody for free. Those kind of things unite the vast majority of Americans. And, you know, if our politicians would only get over the fact that they've got to challenge the powers that be, the powers that finance our elections, we can get some things changed.
I agree. And to paraphrase,
I encourage people to come over to ourfuture.org. It's also going to be on C-SPAN. It's also going to be on the Nation magazine website. And you'll hear more about it as after the conference as well.
Great. Ourfuture.org and populistmajority.org. Roger Hickey. Roger, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Our Future, as in O-U-R, future.org, because it is. It's ours. Let's make it that way. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very immarcessibly ugly. The good, Barack Obama. On Wednesday, the president will use his authority under the Antiquities Act to create the country's newest national monument in the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks region near Las Cruces, New Mexico. The monument will keep miles of pristine desert grasslands, canyons, and petrified forests safe from destructive development, and will also protect a large number of Native American archaeological sites. At over 500,000 acres, it will be the largest national monument President Obama has created during his time in office. Wilderness is part of our commons. Good on the president for making sure that everyone, not just greedy developers, will be able to enjoy it. The bad. Congressman Charles Van Sant. As conservative opposition to Common Core grows, so too does the amount of crazy things Republicans say about this really non-controversial set of national education standards. Case in point, what Florida Congressman Charles Van Sant said during an anti-Common Core rally in March. Check it out.
Go on their website. Click the link to what they're doing with youth. And you will see what their agenda really is. They are promoting as hard as they can any youth that is interested in the LGBT agenda. These people that will now receive $220 million from the state of Florida unless this is stopped will promote double-mindedness in state education and attract every one of your children to become as homosexual as they possibly can.
Right. You know, there are actually legitimate reasons to have concerns or raise flags about Common Core, the main one being how's testing going to be done and are for-profit corporations involved in it. But turning our kids into gays, it's safe to say that's not one of the objections that's reasonable. Having a national set of education standards may or may not be a good policy, but it's definitely not a secret plan to turn your kids gay. And the very, very ugly William Geen. During a recent interview on the Los Angeles-based radio program McIntyre in the Morning, the anti-immigrant activist made what has to be the most offensive remark ever made about undocumented immigrants. Check it out.
If you don't have control of your borders, you're not a nation. It's that
simple. If you don't respect boundaries of countries, why would you expect boundaries of other people sexually or anything else? And that doesn't mean that every illegal immigrant is some type of rapist or murderer.
No, we know
have
that.
A lot of people who are being killed.
Right. Just unbelievably bigoted and very, very ugly. And strange. Okay, the Financial Times has an article. This apropos of this bubble that I've been talking about for a year or so now that I'm seeing, you know, I've been talking about this since 2007 when the housing market started to collapse, and or late 2006. And on this program, I was saying, look out, there's a stock market crash coming. And, you know, for a year, we actually had a home mortgage lender that was advertising with us. And in the middle of 2007, I said, that's it. We're not even going to take their ads anymore. And because it was like this was a housing market driven. It turns out it wasn't even a housing market driven. It looked like it was. It was banksters doing creating derivatives out of mortgages. So you could argue that the housing market had some little piece to do with it. But basically now they're creating derivatives out of rental properties. Right. They're creating derivatives out of oil futures. They're creating derivatives out of anything they possibly can. We're back up to an $800 trillion derivative market when the GDP of the entire planet is only $65 trillion. The GDP of the United States is $15 trillion, and yet you've got American banks with $100, $200, $300 trillion in derivatives on their books. I mean, it's like really scary. So meanwhile, now the housing market is starting to reinflate. In part because, you know, as I keep saying, we never went back and undid the damage that Phil and Wendy Graham did. Wendy Graham was on the board of Enron. Phil Graham was her husband. She also had been the head of the Commodity Exchange Board. I forget the exact correct name. You know, back during the might have been the Clinton administration. I think it was the Bush administration before that. And then she got on the board of directors of Enron. And, you know, Ken Lay's dream was to have an unregulated market in which he could exchange commodities and to unregulate banks so he could own a bank because he had 800 companies and he was moving money around so he could have losses in some companies and take tax write-off, have profit in other companies and take huge dividend income and pay a maximum 20% income tax. He had this scam, this Enron scam going so well. Or at least he thought he did. You think he's actually hiding out someplace? That's one of the conspiracy theories that has always had me scratching my head. Because, you know, Ken Lay was meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger before California started going through the brownouts. And then they went through the brownouts, and Daryl Issa had promoted which were done by Enron, of course. Daryl Issa had promoted the impeachment of Gray Davis, the governor of California at the time, and was successful. He put $1 million of his own money into it. Daryl Issa is the second richest guy in the House of Representatives. He's worth $700 million. And when Daryl Issa discovered that Gray Davis was going down in flames, the repeal or impeachment or whatever was working. When he discovered that Ken Lay had cut a deal with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Schwarzenegger was going to run for governor. You can go back and watch this. I'm sure it's on YouTube. I mean, you know, we all saw it live on television. He broke down crying. Daryl Issa. So anyhow, that damage that Enron did by getting Phil Graham, Wendy's husband, the Republican senator from Texas in 1999 and 2000, getting him to pass the Commodity Futures Modernization Act at Graham Leach Bliley, which deregulated the banks and allowed, you know, the checkbook savings banks, commercial banks, to merge with Merrill Lynch kind of, you know, stock brokerage kind of banks, what are called investment banks, to allow them to merge, and then loosen up the rules on who can own them so Ken Lay could get the banking business, and then let them trade in commodities, which they couldn't do before, in unregulated markets, which they couldn't do before, and trade and create commodities that aren't even actual commodities. A commodity is a thing, right? Pork bellies, oil, gold, silver, oil. Well, I said oil. Electricity. I mean, that was one. But now they're trading in derivatives, on bets, on bets, on bets, on mortgages, or on, you know, home rental properties, or whatever it may be. So anyhow, back to my original rant here. And now I promise I will get to your calls. Front page story, today's Financial Times. Now this is a UK local story, but I think it's happening all over the country. Having just watched one of my kids buy a house and everything that he had to go through, I mean, it was insane to get this mortgage. I think the same thing is happening here. The UK's the headline is Lloyds Bank, right? Big bank in the UK. Probably spun off from Lloyds of London, from the insurance company. Lloyds scales back high-risk home loans. The UK's, and then Sam Fleming wrote this with Charlene Goff and George Parker, and it says the UK's biggest mortgage lender has clamped down on high-risk loans in London amid mounting fears that households in the southeast are overstretching their finances as they chase a rapidly accelerating housing market. I can tell you for sure the same thing is happening in China, and it's happening in places in the United States. And it's not a good sign because we never repaired the fundamentals. We never really fixed our economy. We never fixed the, you know, how it works. Pat in the Dalles, Oregon. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. And boy, I sure appreciate everything you do. I just want to let you know that first off. But are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. the reason I was concerned about this net internet thing.
Net neutrality?
Yeah. It's just, you know, I've been watching the trend for a long time in education, and which I think is one of the most important things, you know, that we can do with ourselves, because that's the thing that civilizes us. And, you know, you have to ask yourself why corporations would be trying to privatize schools, and, you know, why they're trying to... why they've taken over the whole news internet, the whole news thing in our country. You know, the only news we have is from monopolies, and also
so they can make a buck, Pat. It's all about the money.
That. But the thing is, we can't even get any news from Canada or Mexico, and now this internet thing comes along, and so I got to thinking about it. And what do you think about the idea that? Their end game is to control people through ignorance and poverty.
Well, the poverty part they've actually proclaimed. I mean, go back and read Russell Kirk's 1951 book, The Conservative Mind. A middle class is a dangerous thing. It will lead to instability. And sure enough, it did. Look at the 60s and 70s. Kirk was a prophet and is still treated as one by the conservative movement. Ignorance, I would say, yeah. You know, when Reagan became governor of California, the entire University of California system was free. We were sending a man to the moon. We were doing things. And then he became president, we got Reaganomics. And now you can't go to college. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And one of the last portals in, I think the point Pat was making, one of the last portals into that world of news and information is the internet. And they want that now, too. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave in Moorhead, Kentucky. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Talked to you once before. I'm 74 years old, disabled veteran. And I hope that girl keeps on going. We need more young people like her to get this country back on its feet again. The young people are going to have to do it.
Yeah,
and
I think they're going to do it. I really do.
You think so? Huh?
Yeah,
I hope this
Occupy movement thing. You know, it's just getting started. In my opinion.
Well, I don't know. Then on another topic too, on your labor talk, I spent 30 years. up in Ohio in big industry, had seven big companies close on me. So I know about the unions because I was in the unions all the time. Of course, when it came time to retire 4 years before, they screwed me on all the benefits and everything. But at any rate, I've been here in Kentucky now for 7 years. Was always a Democrat until 10 years ago. I went independent. So I got up this morning and was going to go and vote and got to the polling booth. They couldn't find my name. They says, which are you, Democrat or Republican? I said, I'm not. I'm independent. She says, well, you can't vote here. I said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I says, I voted here every year. And she says, yeah, but this is, you get to vote in November, but not in the primaries. You're an independent. We only have Republicans and Democrats voting. So once again, the big boys and old McConnell, boy, I'll tell you, McConnell sure brings the money back here.
Yeah.
Man alive, there's a constant improvement. Like I say, I've seen since I've been here, he drags the money back.
Yeah. Now, Dave, can I just riff on this a little bit? What you've identified is what's called a closed primary system. Kentucky is a state where if you want to say, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, this is my club, then you get to determine who runs your club, basically, who's your candidate. And I think that's a good thing. And here's why I'm opposed to open primaries. If you lived in Michigan, for example, you would have been able to vote in either primary. You'd have to pick one, but you would have been able to say, I'll vote in the Republican primary or I'll vote in the Democratic primary because they have open primaries. I'm old enough to remember when George Wallace ran for president in Michigan, and I think it was 76, 74, whatever. Anyhow, it was back in the 70s. George Wallace ran in Michigan in the Democratic primary, and he was a fringe candidate. Nobody in the party took him seriously, and they expected him to get like 5% of the vote. And the Republicans in Michigan were very organized. They still are. You know, the DeVos family throws all kinds of money into them, the Blackwater family and the Amway company family. And they got the Republicans to go vote in the Democratic primary for George Wallace. And Michigan was so embarrassed by this because George Wallace actually won the Democratic primary and became Michigan's candidate for president of the United States on behalf of the Democratic Party because the Republicans stuck it to him that way. I don't think that should be allowed to happen. I think if somebody has spent 20 years of their life being inside a political party and really cares about it, that they should have a say over the future of that party, not somebody from the other party who wants to mess with it. Am I making sense, Dave?
Yeah, to some degree, but don't you agree that everybody has the right to vote, whether primary or the inter-election?
No, I don't. I think in a primary, you're a member of a club, whether it's a libertarian or green or Democrat or Republican, you're a member of a club, and you declare your affiliation with that club, and you're getting to vote for who runs that club. In a general election, yes, absolutely, I do agree. Dave, I got to go. Thanks for the call, though. Back here, media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, find out what's going on in the world today. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, one of the most brilliant books about how things really work here in Washington, D.C., you will ever find. And the guy who outed the crimes of John Boehner. I still can't figure out why they haven't appointed a federal prosecutor since your book came out, Bob. I
don't know. I can't imagine why somebody hasn't filed an ethics charge.
Yeah, I'm still scratching my head. But, you know, a lot of people buy books and don't read them. Maybe that's it. Anyhow, you are now a reporter. You were a member of the United States House of Representatives. You are now a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, and good on you for it. What's going on in the world today, Bob?
Well, there's a lot going on, but, you know, two stories of particular interest. One deals from Eric Snowden. He's like the gift that just keeps on going. You know, he's talked about the fact of, I guess, 5 to 6 million some people in the Caribbean have been taped by the NSA. And they're saying, of course, that I think it was Senator Harkin, Oprah Winfrey, Nicolas Cage, that right. They spied on the Bahamas and maybe got Oprah on tape, too, because they own houses down there.
Right.
There's this extensive 5 to 6 million some American tourists who visited the Caribbean. And the document, the NSA calls the program a test bed for system deployments, capabilities, and improvements, a long name.
In other words, we can do this in every country in the world or any place we want to.
That's right.
Wow.
And they also, the indication there is that the officials plan to export it to other nations.
Wow.
We're going to do.
It, you know, what's amazing to me is that Edward Snowden has still got stuff to release. I mean, that's just, and I'm assuming actually it was probably Glenn Greenwald who released it, because Snowden gave it all to Greenwald, and then Snowden's deal with Putin was that he would stop releasing things. So this must have come out of the Greenwald machine, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, the government's furious with him,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But I just think it's very interesting, you know, when people say, whether he's a traitor or he's a hero, Snowden, just think it's very interesting. We wouldn't even be having this conversation, because I doubt the government would have said, oh, by the way, we just want to let you know we're doing these things.
Right. No, that ain't going to happen. No, that ain't going to happen. This is like a 1973 moment, I think.
Oh, it is. And then the other story that I really find of interest is the Credit Suisse, as they call it, which is the Swiss bank. Now, they became the first financial institution in more than a decade. They pled guilty to a crime yesterday. And this is through our Department of Justice, of course. But it admitted it conspired to aid tax evasion, and it agreed to pay $2.6 billion to settle this long-running probe by the Department of Justice.
Right. They admitted that they're helping American billionaires avoid paying American taxes.
Yes, knowingly and willfully helped thousands of the U.S. clients, a lot of billionaires, open accounts, conceal their assets and income from the Internal Revenue Service.
Right.
Senator Carl Levin, the Democratic member from Michigan, his committee in the Senate led an investigation into this bank, and he said, quote, it is a mystery to him why the government didn't require that the bank cough up some of the names. And that's not going to go away on the Hill, because, you know, why would, as the plea, why wouldn't there be the individuals named? Because this Swiss bank knowingly and help them to evade American Internal Revenue Service.
Right. But what happens when we find out that the people involved are political? You know, I mean, what if it's, you know, some famous right-wing donor or a famous left-wing donor, you know? George Soros or the Koch brothers, I mean, something like that. It's then all of a sudden the politicians start getting very nervous.
Well, they would. And this goes to a larger issue, which the Attorney General Eric Holder last year made a bit of a misstep, which he did back away from over a period of time, which was saying, well, you know, you really can't criminally charge banks, because if you did, they might fail, and that would be financially a ruin for America. Now, that's because of a federal charter, but the United States Congress, if it would so please, in 10 seconds could say, you can indict the president of the bank, the entire board of directors, whoever you want who's guilty,
right,
or perceived to be guilty, and that doesn't mean we shut the bank down. So
right,
this whole protectionism and these fines, which, as you know, Tom, sound, you know, amazing, because it is amazing money, but that doesn't take into account of how much profit did they really make, and they don't really mind paying this fine because they made a bundle of money on top of it.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. And if the bank is making, you know, more than a couple $1 billion from Americans who are hiding their assets overseas, they must be hiding trillions.
Oh, yes, that's correct.
Or hundreds of billions.
So they had to
make
a lot of money.
I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
It is.
Yeah. So what else is going on around the world?
Well, on a domestic issue, the dealing with Republicans released an ag budget. Interestingly enough, in there, they've inserted new language that requires Ag Department to establish a waiver process for local school districts that claim to have found it just too costly to comply with tougher nutrition standards. And, of course, these are the standards championed by no other than First Lady Michelle Obama.
Yeah, there's a swipe at Michelle Obama. There was also something in this new ag bill that said that the benefits, federal money that goes to, school lunch programs or something like that, that it no longer can go to urban people, only rural people. And, you know, basically, this is code for black and white, is it not?
Yes, because the Republicans, I really don't understand this one, how they'll justify it. The language specifically says only rural areas are to benefit in the future from funding requested by the administration this year to continue the demonstration programs to help kids from low-income households.
Right. Now, only rural areas may benefit in the future that's yeah. So in other words, Obama can appropriate all the money he wants. It's all going to go to poor white people who are living out in the country. None of it's going to go to poor black people living in the cities.
Yes, and you know,
how could they put language like that in and not? I mean, they just have to assume that the average American is an idiot, or that the media is not going to cover any of this stuff.
I imagine they must, because I don't know how you justify this. Well, we're only going to put the money in for the rural areas.
Right.
Because kids obviously don't need to eat in urban centers.
Right. Right.
To do that.
Yeah. It's nuts. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, former member of the U.S. House of Representatives, reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Bob, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Always good talking to you. We will be back right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Louise just called me. She just got back from the acupuncturist. I got to tell you, this is amazing. We kind of started out the program with this whole thing about would you take a drug, an experimental drug, if there was a small chance that it might, the chance that it would save your life? I mean, typically that's not even there. Complete remissions are pretty rare, although there are some. But typically, I mean, I look at these studies. And I have family members who've been enrolled in them, as and friends as well. And, you know, they're considering success having a 20-month mean survival time turn into a 27-month mean survival time, or actually even a 25-month survival time or week. So, you know, would you take a drug knowing that there's a possibility it would kill you, it would shorten your life, it would horribly ruin the quality of your life, but there's a small chance you'd live longer? Or not, and should the drug companies be deregulated somewhat, as the Goldwater Institute is suggesting, in order to be able to do more of this? And I mentioned that when Louise got breast cancer, she took a drug that is like $100,000 a year for this particular type of breast cancer. There's very few types of breast cancer that actually have a drug for them, and there's this particular drug is available for this particular type of breast cancer. And she's clear, as far as we can tell, as a consequence of this. 7 years ago, or 10 years ago, something like that, sometimes many years ago, another member of our team, an actual, you know, one of the people who works on the show, his wife got breast cancer, and it was the exact same kind of breast cancer Louise has, and was enrolled in a trial for this drug that Louise took. But it was one of these placebo-controlled trials where half the women get the drug and half the women get just a shot, and they don't know whether the drug's in it or not. And she got just the placebo, and she died. One of the people who works on this show. And it just, you know, it just turned his life upside down. They had couple of young kids and the whole thing. So, you know, I get the value of the studies, and I get the value of saying, hey, I'll take the drug. But, you know, on the other hand, as I mentioned, another member of our family didn't do so well with one of these trials and was just, you know, basically killed by the drug, although he was dying already. So anyhow, I bring that up. Not just to kind of bring up the topic again, but because, as I said, Louisa's called me during the break. We, you know, there's news at the top of the hour, and she called to say hi. She had just walked 3 miles home from the acupuncturist. One of the side effects of the chemo that Louise took was that her one of her legs has neuropathy. You know, it damaged the nerves. I mean, chemo does all kinds of incredible damage to you that they don't tell you about. And you don't read about until, and you don't learn about until you're actually on it. You know, it just really whacks the body hard, and the brain. And Louise has come through it quite well, except that she has, you know, a large chunk of her I think it's her left leg, her lower left leg, that she can't feel a thing, which can be really dangerous. And it's also been slowly withering away. It's been kind of dying, you know, because the nerves aren't there and they're not, so it's not getting fed. It's called chemo-induced neuropathy. And so finally I don't know if frustration is the right word, because we've always thought acupuncture was a good thing. We tried it when Louise wanted to get pregnant with our second child. We tried and tried for years and years and didn't work. And we went to an acupuncturist and bang, she got pregnant. So she said, let's try this. And there's a new acupuncturist. I don't know if she's new. There's an acupuncturist here in Washington, D.C., and Louise went to see her, and she said while the needles were in her, she could just feel this river of ice is what it felt like flowing through her leg. It was the first sensation she'd felt in a year. And she walked all the way home and felt her leg all the way home. And she's like, this is incredible. I said, can I tell people about this on the air? And she's like, yeah, sure. I've told you before, back in 1986, in November of 1986, I spent a month in Beijing, China, living at the Beijing International Acupuncture Teaching Hospital. There's an actual, much more formal name for it, which I can't remember. And it's interesting because the last time I mentioned it on the air, I got an email from somebody saying, hey, I was there the month before you were, and who, you know, named the hotel. And you know, one of my roommates who is now a doctor in New York City, a psychiatrist, in fact, he knew him. I mentioned him on the air, and the other two roommates, these two Japanese guys, he knew them. I didn't get to know them all that well, but I have kept in touch with my other roommate, who is, like I said, this psychiatrist in New York. And he stayed there, actually, I think for 2 years, he became very good at it. What I did with regard to acupuncture in that month that I was there in China was the equivalent of going on a resort dive, you know, where you hop in the pool 3 or 4 times with a tank on, and they teach you how to use the tank and how to clear your mask and get it to the point where you're not panicking in the water. And then they take you out, and Louise and I have done this in Mexico and in the Philippines and in Hawaii and, you know, various places around the world. And then you never go below 25 feet. And Australia, we snorkeled off the Great Barrier Reef. But it's sort of the learning acupuncture equivalent of resort dives or the bunny slopes, you know, for the beginners who are just learning how to ski. I didn't want to learn to be an acupuncturist, although I still have the needles and I still do it to myself occasionally. But I wanted to learn if there was anything to it. I was really curious about it. I had been into herbal medicine in a big way back in the 70s. And this was, you know, we had sold our business in 1986, the travel agency in Atlanta. We moved to Germany for a year and did a lot of traveling around Europe. And this opportunity opened up. It was 200, as I recall, $235 for the month, or for maybe it was per week. And that included a one-on-one doctor, a one-on-one translator, room and board. You could buy a meal for 5 cents. The tallest building in Beijing at the time was either the Hilton or the Hyatt, or it was one or the other. It was one of those hotels that starts with H. It was 10 or 12 stories, and they had a steakhouse at the top, and they made pizzas. It was basically the only Western restaurant. It was a very poor country at that time. This was the year or two before Tiananmen Square, and I remember standing before the revolt, and I remember standing on Tiananmen Square on this giant highway there and watching this river of cars. But anyhow, the way that it worked at the hospital is every morning we would learn a meridian. Every day was a different meridian, and we'd learn the Chinese name of it, and we'd learn what it does. And then we'd spend, you know, the last couple hours of the morning sticking needles in oranges, learning how to needle, proper technique. And then in the afternoon, we'd go out in the wards, and they'd have, this was a 500-person hospital, and they had these rooms divided into, okay, all these people have Bell's palsy, all these people have this or that, you know, whatever it may be. They had people divided by disease, basically. And so we would be needling, you know, everybody pretty much similarly, and the doctor would work with us one-on-one, and we'd practice sticking needles in people. And I've seen it work. Why don't we do more of this kind of stuff in this country? You know, herbal treatments, I realize it's very in vogue to ridicule herbs. I've been using herbs ever since I was in my 20s, and I still do. I've got 5 bottles sitting right behind me. And I think they make me healthy. I know that acupuncture works. My personal experience, I broke my back skydiving when I was 20 years old, and I've used chiropractic ever since, and I get incredible relief from that. I know chiropractic works, at least for people who've had spinal injuries. Why don't we insure this stuff? Why don't we do this stuff? Why the skepticism? You know, I brought up helminthic therapy earlier. The problem is nobody can make a buck at this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's not even so much nobody can make a buck at it. It's that nobody can get rich at it. And that's why it happens all over the world. I mean, our German doctor was an herbalist, but not here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carol, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite TV in Dillon, Montana. Hey, Carol, what's up? Carol? You are on the air. Uh-oh. Carol's watching her TV and not listening to her telephone. Cardinal sin. William in Mastic Beach, New York, watching Free Speech on the Direct TV satellite. How you doing, William?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I just want to say
thank you. You're doing a great job. I don't know how you have so much patience with some of these Republican guests you have on. It's amazing.
Well, thank you. I hope I'm a good role model. You know,
You are a great role model. I wish I get so angry watching your show that I yell at the TV. Mm. I don't know how you don't.
Well, that's good. Then I'm doing my job. If you're yelling and I'm not, I'm doing my job.
Doing a wonderful job.
Thanks.
I was calling because one of your calls earlier about MS. I was wondering if you could recommend a website or anything I could find out more about the mitochondria aspect.
The mitochondrial stuff, I don't know anything about. Mitochondria are they're really little cells inside our cells. They have their own DNA. They are the engines that convert sugars and things into energy for the cell. And there's even a really interesting evolutionary theory that mitochondria, that the very first single-cell organism became before we had multicellular organisms, mitochondria evolved, and it was like the first kind of sort of multi-cell organism because it's almost like a cell within a cell. The woman was talking about mitochondrial therapy, which is basically feeding the engine, because the mitochondria, every cell in your body has mitochondria in it, and the mitochondria is this little piece that occupies maybe 10% of the cell that produces the energy for the cell. It's like the engine in a car. And
The only thing I know about mitochondria is that it's been found in bacteria in meteorites.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Mitochondrial DNA is the DNA that I think follows the female lineage. I might be wrong, but I might just be thinking maternal. In any case, I am way out of my league with organic chemistry and biology. It's been 40 years, and although I do read and keep up, what I was talking about she was talking about the mitochondrial therapy. I'm guessing you can probably search that on the internet with DuckDuckGo.com. What I was talking about was helminthic therapy, which is literally having somebody give you 20 or 30 worm eggs, and you eat them, and this is not enough to cause a disease. It's not enough to even cause indigestion. But what the worms do is they're microscopic, but they're about the size of a hair, and they thread themselves into the intestines, and they just live there. But in order to keep the body from rejecting them, they produce a protein on the surface of their bodies that down-regulates our immune system. And the theory is that for 165,000 years, we all always had worms. And so we always, the worms were part of our body. They were part of our ecosystem, and they were always down-regulating our immune system. And when we started getting rid of the worms really aggressively in the 1950s and 1960s in America, and it used to be kids had pinworm epidemics in public schools in the 1950s. I personally remember this. But, you know, we got rid of that. And as a consequence, they're not down-regulating the immune system. And the result of that is that we're getting all of these autoimmune disorders, from asthma to MS to other things. And this body of knowledge about this, helminthictherapy.com, I think, is the website. And Helminthic Therapy, H-E-L-M-I-N-T-H-I-C, therapy. You can track it down. William, thanks for the call. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking truths to the multinational corporations that they really rather didn't know all about. Ken in Silver City, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, Ken, what's up? Net neutrality?
Net neutrality. Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I was listening to Pat, and what he was saying is a done deal already with the FCC.
I'm not ready to throw in that towel.
Yeah, I feel the same way. But I would think that we take a dual approach here. If you want to fight with the FCC, that's good. But we also have, you know, internet. We have satellite Wi-Fi internet already existing on every mobile phone that we have. We have municipal Wi-Fi. Every cop has a computer in his car with internet on it. I would rather see Wi-Fi. Canada is starting to do with a municipal Wi-Fi.
We've got a couple cities in America that have done it. I think the largest is, isn't it Chattanooga? We did a show on this recently. It's one of the, it's either in Tennessee or Kentucky, and it's one of the biggest cities I'm pretty sure it's Chattanooga. They've got a citywide Wi-Fi system, and it is high speed, and the people love it.
Yeah, and it's great. And I would rather pay my local community, you know, $20 a month rather than Comcast, and let them fix potholes and let them go to schools, you know, put in money into the schools and stuff.
Yep.
I think that would be a wonderful thing. Plus, the mobile phones, they're already considered or classified as a common carrier, public.
Only the telephone part of that.
Existing.
Only the telephone part of that.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the thing about common carrier status on a phone is that basically it's illegal for AT&T, if they're your phone company, to listen into your telephone conversation. For example, if you were calling me on an AT&T cell phone right now, they can't listen into yourself to this conversation and say, hey, Ken's talking on a nationally syndicated radio show. That's a profit-making venture. We're going to charge Ken an extra 5 cents for this phone call. They can't do that. They can't charge you based on the content of your call. However, if they blow up net neutrality, if you've got a smartphone and you pull up a website and, you know, a particular website, they can say, okay, we're either going to, A, charge Ken more because he's decided to look at this website, or we're going to slow down the speed at which it's been delivered. Now, all the conversation up to this point has just been, you know, the speed at which it's going to be delivered. But the part that's kind of hiding in the background that they haven't gotten to yet is what's called tiered pricing. And that's how they do it. These same companies, I mean, it's no mystery why Comcast is all over this, because Comcast, you know, kind of pioneered this or helped pioneer, and AT&T as well, and Verizon, in the cable business. Oh, here's basic cable. You get Fox for free, plus you get, you know, 93 channels. But you want to watch HBO, that's an extra $10. You want to watch Showtime, it's an extra $5. You want to watch MSNBC right here in Washington, D.C. I have to pay an extra $5 a month just to see MSNBC because it's a, quote, premium channel. And so what they want to do with the Internet, or what I predict they will do with the Internet if we blow up Internet neutrality, is not just that the big providers like Netflix are going to have to, you know, kick in money. Netflix just raised their prices. I don't know if you noticed. It's because they just cut this deal where they're giving Comcast millions of dollars. It's not just on that end. It's going to be on our end. They're going to say, okay, here's the basic package. Here's 5,000 websites you can visit. But if you want to go to BBC and stream their audio, you're going to have to buy the international package, and that's an extra $5. Or if you want to be, using Skype a lot, then you're going to have to buy the audiovisual package, and that's an extra $5 a month. And they'll have, you know, in the basic package, it'll be like 35 or 40, and then you can get all these add-ons that, you know, oh, you want to go to the porn sites? That's $25 a month. That's my prediction of how they're going to do it. And it certainly comports with all the ways that they are writing these rules and regulations. Makes sense, Ken?
Well, as far as Yeah, as far as a municipal, what would be the process on getting our local city to do it? Would this be a ballot?
Take it to the city council.
Or something pushing?
Take it to the city council. I don't know the every state has its own laws and every city has its own laws, and I don't know how things get on the ballot in Silver City, New Mexico. But I would start out by just make an appointment with the member of your city council who you think is probably the most closely aligned with your worldview, and ask them, how can we make this happen, and particularly if you're willing to kick in some time to help make it happen. And maybe they might even make it a campaign issue. I mean, if they're successful, people in Chattanooga love it. If they can love it in Silver City, it might get this guy reelected or this woman reelected. So that's where I would start, is with your city council.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot, Ken. And this is why it's so important. You know, with a smartphone, the telephone part of it is common carrier already. They can't listen to your phone calls and charge you based on what you're saying or who you're talking to. But the internet part, they're talking about, first of all, they passed on the opportunity to declare it common carrier 3 years ago. Has not been done. And they're talking about moving even farther away from that. That's why what we need to do is move it toward common carrier. Monica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Monica, what's up?
I heard you mentioning about the phone.
You're talking about the agriculture bill?
No, the agriculture bill. Has that been passed where they will not allow the children in cities to get free lunches?
I was a little off in my information. It's not about the lunch program. It is President Obama has expanded with the last agriculture bill. The Obama administration and the Democrats in Congress expanded some of the programs that increase the nutritional content and the quality of meals, and also things that have to do with things like food stamps and food support for people all across the country. It all has to do with food because it's in the ag bill. What the Republicans are proposing, and no, it has not passed, what the Republicans are proposing is that anything that has to do with increasing food security for Americans can only apply to people in rural areas, cannot apply to people in the cities. And this is, as you can imagine, very strange, but this is what the Republicans are, there's no way the Democrats are going to let this pass. But and we all know, the poor people in the rural areas, by and large, are white. There are, there's no shortage of black people who are poor in the rural areas. But and the rural and urban people who are poor, by and large, are black. I'm just astounded the Republican Party would come right out and say this, Monica.
The cities and forcing people out to suburbs.
Yeah, well, it raises an interesting question. Do they consider suburbs rural or urban? Because that's the new place where poverty is starting to happen. Monica, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Lots of fascinating tricks the Republicans are up to these days. But to just come right out and say, more money for people, poor people in the country, not in the city. Welcome back, Tom Harvin here with you, 28 minutes before the hour, and Roger in Jennings, Florida. Hey, Roger, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, in your news feed, you speak about a new wave of populism.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to personally testify to this. Back in 2011, I was an Occupy Wall Street organizer in Davenport, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And even back then, I made a prediction that the time will come when the American people will get wise to the ideological divide.
Right.
And they will start merging between conservative and liberal. And I overheard a march going on yesterday. I caught the ending part of that story of yours.
Yeah.
You're talking about
the 99 Rise?
Yes. All this is just a very exciting and wonderful time where the American people will begin to realize that we have just one commonality now. I personally, I consider myself a voice in this movement. For 7 years, I traveled the country as a trucker.
I was a teacher before that, and I became a trucker so I can see my America and talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just published a book called The Socratic Trucker with a populist message.
Oh, really? Socratic trucker?
Socratic.
Oh, that's so cool. As in the Socratic teaching method.
I have a liberal education.
Yeah. Yeah, got it.
I have a liberal arts education, and I was a student of philosophy. And I went ahead and I spoke to my fellow Americans in the spirit of living an intentional life.
Yeah, I love it.
And
so, Roger, your book is if I go to the usual suspects, I can find Socratic Teacher, your book?
You could go to Amazon, and you can find it there. It's also on Kindle.
Cool.
It's called the Socratic, from the Socratic.
That's
method,
great. Okay, wonderful. With regard to your comments on the rise, on 99 Rise and the new populism, I'm totally with you. I think what has happened is that in the there was an understanding in the 1930s after the great crash after 1929, there was a very clear understanding that we being the 99% of Americans, we were all being screwed by the 1%. And Franklin Roosevelt called them out. He called them these economic royalists, you know, and he said they seek to destroy the institutions of, you know, on and on. I could quote Roosevelt all day long. Everybody got it. And the people who were alive, and particularly people who were young in the 1930s, got it. And they lived into the 40s and 50s and 60s and kind of passed the torch along. And then I remember in 1964, actually, I don't remember when it happened. I didn't learn about it until 3 years later, 67, when I joined SDS. But I think it was in 64, Tom Hayden co-authored the Port Huron Statement, which was the founding document of Students for Democratic Society, which was not about the Vietnam War. It ultimately took, you know, SDS's major portfolio became the Vietnam War, but originally it was not. This was before anybody really even knew about the war. This was about organizing students for social justice, racial justice, and economic justice in the United States, peace and justice. And the Port Huron Statement is a brilliant, examination of how the American plutocrats were trying to make a comeback and take us back to, you know, the Gilded Age, back to the 1870s, and the horrors of that era. And it's still worth reading. And Tom Hayden is still a genius. In fact, I just saw him last week up in Massachusetts. And we were both speaking at the same venue there at the Democracy for America thing. And then, and in the 60s and the 70s, people got it. And people were in the streets marching and they got it. That generation got it. And then Reagan came into office and with this whole, literally the Reagan Revolution, and this whole idea that no, government isn't actually we the people, like it says in the Constitution. It's actually some foreign, awful thing that we should hate as much as the billionaires hate because it wants to tax the billionaires and regulate their oil refineries. And it caught on. Between the shills for the billionaires, we're talking on right wing talk radio, and the media watchdogs, and then Reagan deregulating everything and stopping enforcing the antitrust laws. So everything got bigger and bigger and bigger. And the voices of we, the people, the average person, the media started shrinking. And I believe that now, 33 years later, this new awakening is happening, and it's happening not that different from the way it happened in the 1920s. And in fact, I wrote a book about it called The Crash of 2016, and that it is a new populist movement. I think Ralph Nader, with his new book, Unstoppable, is absolutely right, and that it's transpartisan. It's totally transpartisan. So,
well, I'm coming from the common man's point of view.
Yeah.
In and among Americans, talking to them as a common trucker, a common ordinary fellow, and even though I came from an intellectual background, but I learned to humble myself and respect my fellow man, and out of this came this, when I was an Occupy Wall Street organizer in Davenport, I wrote a number of op-eds in the Quad City Times and in newspapers about my prediction for a surge of populism, and that was way back in 2011.
Yeah.
And I've been working on an organizational concept for this called New American Spring at newamericanspring.org.
Yeah.
And then the book came out as, the story of how these concepts developed.
That is
cool. I am very excited to see this happening in all different ways. You know, there's even an organization I've learned about in Tallahassee, Florida, called To the Village Square.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about also, in an organizational fashion, trying to bridge between the liberal and the conservative and bringing the people together in ancient in the spirit of ancient politics.
Yeah, I'm totally with you.
Examples.
Roger.
I'm just seeing so many examples all over, and I just wanted to say, you know, this is the time for we the people to come together, and thank you, Tom, for the work that you do. And may we all just see a bright new future for America.
I thank you, Roger. Very, very well said. I am an absolute optimist. I think that some dark days are ahead, but I think they're birth pains. I think what's going to come out of them is something new and extraordinary. Jane in Round Mountain, California, you wanted to get back to our earlier conversation about loosening up the rules on experimental drugs.
I guess in some ways, Tom. First of all, that was such a lovely, heartening story about Louise walking 3 miles and not feeling any neuropathy.
Yeah.
That's great. I have problems with neuropathy, and I know how it can be. But what I wanted to tell you, my background is 15 years as an oncology nurse and another 15 years as a hospice nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And the jump from being an oncology nurse to hospice probably was a very logical step for me, because as an oncology nurse, I would sit there with a patient while a doctor would come in and tell them about their chemotherapy that they're going to start and say things like, well, you know, it's just like having a touch of the flu, and just downplaying the symptoms.
Yeah.
And patients, I mean, they're in the doctor's hands. And even now, I mean, I'm talking, 20 years ago, it's the way the doctors present their chances of surviving. And I don't want to bash all oncologists, because I've worked with some really great ones in my time. But the survival, to take a medication on a trial basis. Now, I don't know if you're talking about the official clinical trials where, the highest level is to determine the maximum lethal dose. Are you talking about those kind of clinical trials?
Well, I offered, I think, three different anecdotes, and I'm not sure which one you're talking about. But basically what I was talking about is there is a system in place right now for doing clinical trials. And what the Goldwater Institute is suggesting is that we should deregulate that, basically, liberalize it. And I'm a little worried about, that. I think somebody who really knows what they're talking about needs to be in the room when those conversations are happening. And if that's the FDA, that's the FDA.
Because that's such a personal decision. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, if I had a terminal cancer diagnosis and I was given, the option of taking a drug, first of all, I want to know what's my quality of life going to be if I take this drug. Can you give me any information on that?
Yeah.
And secondly, I'd probably do it as an altruistic thing, because it may benefit somebody down the road, just like you told stories of the person that you worked with whose wife died and their Louise is, walking 3 miles.
Yeah.
So from an altruistic point of view, I think that's okay. But, oh, my gosh, I mean, I have seen people so, so sick and dying, and they're offered, we can give you 3 more months. And it's like, but what are those 3 months going to be like?
Right.
You may be suffering.
Jane, we just have a minute till the break is going to hit us. Can I ask you a frame question? It sounds to me like you went from a life as an oncology nurse, from the frame of we're doing battle with illness, to now as a hospice nurse, we are helping people make the transition into the light, out of this life and into whatever's next.
Be comfortable. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really what I was saying when I said, if somebody came to me and said, I can give you an extra couple months of life, maybe, and there may be terrible side effects, and I would say no, is because I'm not afraid to go into the light. I think that there's too many people who are. I think that's such a part of our culture.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Your thoughts on that?
I think I'm kind of like a nascent Buddhist.
Yeah.
And I believe totally in what you're saying. I mean, death is something that, doctors think they can be lord over, and it's just not possible.
Yeah, death is not a disease. It's a part of life.
It's part of life.
Yeah, yeah. Well said. Jane, thank you so much for the call. I very much appreciate the thoughtful calls. We'll be right back.
You're You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, you can check into our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com. It's free. It's fun. It's some of the greatest minds on earth. Welcome back. Peg in Congress, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Peg, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First off, I want to thank you for your program. You give me hope. My partner, 22 years, and I, 8 years ago, moved to Arizona from the state of Pennsylvania. Go figure. So I'm hoping that your statement early in the program about marriage equality spreading across the country by the first of the year is will happen.
I think
but I also wanted to comment about earlier in the program you talked about acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
4 years ago, I was walking with a cane secondary to an arthritic right knee. I was seeing an orthopod who gave me two series of Suparts injections, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's synthetic synovial fluid that they inject into your knee, and I got a little bit of relief from that. But ultimately, the orthopod suggested a total knee replacement, which I flatly refused. And a friend recommended that I start acupuncture, which I thought was totally nuts. But at that point, I was barely walking and in so much pain, I was willing to try anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried. I started treatments with this woman who has studied in China. And I am now totally pain-free, walking unassisted. I'm a Native American sun dancer, and for the last 3 years have sun danced 4 days in a row from sunrise to sunset.
Wow.
I am a total believer in acupuncture. Don't know, of course, that it would fix all the ills for everyone, but I certainly would highly recommend it for anyone who is feeling hopeless because of their physical condition.
Well, I can tell you when I was at the acupuncture teaching hospital that if somebody showed up with a bacterial infection, you know, just a good old-fashioned infection, a case of venereal disease or an open sore that was oozing or something like that, they would send them to the allopathic hospital down the road, and they would say, go get some antibiotics. And then come back and, you know, we can do acupuncture to deal with any kind of damage that might have been done to your body from that infection. But anything that was a degenerative condition, anything that was an autoimmune disorder, anything that had to do with the nervous system, the lymph system, the digestive system, anything that was not infectious, they were just all over. And some of them, they were having remarkable, I mean, I saw personally some just miracles. I mean, remarkable successes.
Yeah.
I also saw some people who just didn't get better at all, and it was very frustrating to everybody, not the least the patient, but also the doctors. And, you know, so I there's that spectrum, and I'm sure that spectrum occurs, you know, whether it's somebody taking antibiotics or whether it's somebody taking acupuncture. But that's a great story you've got, Peg.
All right. Okay, thank you, Tom.
Sure.
I appreciate the work you do.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. And Shane said tells me we've got 20 seconds before the music is going to step on me, so it's not enough time to bring another caller in. We'll do that right after the break. But I'm a big believer in acupuncture, and, you know, having seen it work, and I'm so glad that Louise finally got it together to get over there. You know, great idea. In fact, she said, you know, now you're next. I'm like, cool. Let's do it. And this woman charges $60 an hour here in Washington, D.C. I mean, for an hour. Right. I mean, you can't find a doctor who will charge $60 for 5 minutes. It's amazing. Anyway, we'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before we go. Tom Harbin here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. David, listening to the Progressive Voices channel over on TuneIn Radio in State College, Pennsylvania. David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Great pleasure to talk to you. And I do want to mention I appreciate your historical development that you bring to everything. I'm calling because I just want to support what the last caller just said and what I heard about your wife. Acupuncture saved my life.
Really?
I have a disease in my neck. It's called degenerative disc disease. I had never heard of it.
I'm an educator. I've spent 20 years teaching outdoors, basically 6th, 7th grade science, taking kids outdoors, teaching them about the environment, getting them excited, helping them be interested in science. That means a backpack. That means walking around the hills. And one day my left arm stopped working. Pretty scary. I didn't do anything with acupuncture until it was a last resort, and what do you know? It worked. I got acupuncture for 3 years. I had to move. You don't need to hear my whole life story. I don't have it anymore, and it's a pain in the neck, quite literally.
You don't have the degenerative spinal disease any longer that you used to have.
No. I don't have the acupuncture.
Oh, you don't have the acupuncture.
I had to lose my old health insurance. Luckily for the Affordable Care Act, which I do not call Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, I have insurance again, but it doesn't cover it. And I'm seeking out ways to get this treatment again and doing what I can in the meantime. I just want to let you know and your listeners know acupuncture absolutely, totally works. My arm works again. I'm out walking around again. I can put some weight on my back again. I never would have believed this until it started being done to me.
Yeah.
So I'm really grateful for it. I really want to ask you a question since I got you on the phone and based on what I just heard with the other callers on the air about Reagan. It was my first election. My question to you, Tom, would be, do you really blame Reagan, who I personally believe was an absentee actor president? I always look at that situation as, what was Ted Kennedy's, what was on his mind when he challenged Jimmy Carter for the nomination? I saw that as the beginning to the end, and I was young then,
and
it still looks like it. That would be my big question to you. And again, thanks for everything that you do.
Sure. Well, let's discuss that for a second. First of all, when Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter, I don't think that that's the reason why Reagan won the election of 1980, that Carter had a primary challenge. That hurt Carter. But Carter was beating Reagan really soundly in the polls right up until just a few months before the election. The thing that caused Carter to lose the election was that he was unable to free the hostages in Iran. And it was being covered.
The October surprise, as it were.
Literally every night on the news, right. And you know, President Banisadr of Iran has now, you can find this, it was published in the March, I don't remember the day, but it was in March of last year in the Christian Science Monitor. It's still on their website. He was responding to the movie Argo, and he said, in 1980, I ran for president of Iran on the platform of freeing the hostages. I won with over 76% of the vote. I went to the Ayatollah and I said, time to free the hostages. This is now September of 1980. At that point, Carter is just starting to slip behind Reagan in the polls because of the hostages. And he said, I went to the Ayatollah and said, time to free the hostages and fulfill my campaign promise to my people. And the Ayatollah said, you can't do that because we cut a deal with the Reagan campaign, and the Israelis are already starting to deliver spare tires for the F-15s that the Shah left over. And, and that became the Iran-Contra deal. I mean, you know, this is for 6 years.
Do you believe that even forget about the Ted Kennedy challenge, this, all would have happened anyway?
No, I don't think so. I really think that if the Reagan campaign had not committed treason, that Jimmy Carter would have gotten a second term. And we would be energy independent by today. I don't know if you got that clip of Jimmy Carter talking about the energy independence.
Is there any recourse to deal with some of those people who are still active, who were part of that treason? It still baffles me that went down, and we know this.
George Herbert Walker Bush issued a blanket pardon to all of them on his way out. So he just an absolute blanket pardon, just like Jerry Ford did with Nixon and his crimes. Do you have the clip? Listen, this is what Jimmy Carter said a year before the end of his presidency. He actually put this into law. This is why when you travel around the country, if you're looking at a house to buy, you'll find all kinds of solar off-the-grid houses. All of them were built in 1979 and 1980. Listen to this.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts. And we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never. Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
So my position is, if the Reagan Revolution, which was a genuine revolution, Ronald Reagan truly changed this country, and I agree with you, he was more of a useful idiot than anything else. When he married Nancy Davis, he was a Democrat. Her father sat him down and said, son, let me tell you the facts of life. You want to go big on this, you got to turn conservative. And Ronnie did. And because he gave some very impassioned speeches for Truman back in the 40s, in the election of 48. But, you know, without the Reagan Revolution, I think this country would be so different and so much better. David, I'm sorry we don't have time to discuss it at more length, but we're literally at the end of the show. Thank you for calling, and thanks for listening to Progressive Voices. We will be back tomorrow with more. There's always something going on. The most important thing to remember, though, is that democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually requires participation of all of us. That's you, that's me, all of us. So get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.